there's any objection from anybody, I think I'll call the meeting to order. Today's date is the 19th of January 2011. The time, at least that I have, is 12:35. I would ask Joyce to turn on the tape and take roll.
And the tape is recording, right?
Mm-hmm. Going.
Hey, Senator Stevens.
Here.
Senator Coghill.
Here.
Tony Mallott is not here at the moment. Herman Walker is unable to attend. Skip Cook.
Here.
Gary Turner.
Here.
Connor Thomas.
Here.
Chair, and we also have Representative Tuck sitting in for Representative Gardner. Mr. Chair, we do have a quorum. We need at least two legislators and three public members, and we do have that, so we have a quorum present.
Okay, thank you. And for those of you that may or may not know, normally, of course, we have two members from the House that sit in. However, since yesterday was the first day of the session, there were members that were nominated to the committee. However, they weren't voted on for the committee, so we actually have no confirmed House members here with us today. And so we do have a quorum to proceed as long as there are two legislators, and, of course, we have the two members in the Senate. So that's the reason for the lineup that you see before you right now. We are, as indicated on teleconference, is there anybody online for the meeting? The heads are shaking, and that in a negative direction, so the answer to that is no. Dan Wayne, who's our legal counsel, is here. Thanks, Dan, for coming by. Appreciate that. Would ask people to identify themselves when you speak for the benefit of anybody who might be listening, at any rate, later on the teleconference. Today we'll have a full committee meeting. I think the agenda has been out for most of you to take a look at. There are quite a few things on there. We do have a House subcommittee listed. However, since there are no members from the House, we're not going to have the House subcommittee, so that will be canceled, even though it may appear on the agenda that you have before you. I would ask for approval of the agenda. And there is one amendment. Joyce has indicated that there's a portion of the agenda that has to do with the rules of procedure. There's a section item that would be labeled 8G, section 14 complaints, which she's asked to add to the agenda. So with that amendment, I would ask seek a motion for approval of the agenda.
So moved.
Without objection, the agenda as amended is approved. Would move on from there. I would welcome the new legislative members, which is on here. All of the two legislative members from the Senate aren't that new to the committee. However, thank you for agreeing to serve again. And Representative Tuck, you're an alternate, correct? So anyway, thank you for coming today, and I appreciate you being willing to serve on the committee. Senator Donnie Olson is also going to be an alternate for Senator Coghill, is my understanding. So is that correct? Okay. Right. The next item is approval of minutes. You should have before you the minutes from the meeting of June 16th, 2010. So I would seek or request a motion for approval of the minutes.
So moved.
Any requests for modifications, changes? The next item is the House Subcommittee Minutes of November 23, 2010.
Move approval.
Any requests for amendments, changes? Hearing none. Minutes are approved. The next item, next minutes, so would be House Subcommittee Minutes of December 13th, 2010, which these are all in your packet. They're sort of salmon colored. This is the last one, so I would seek a motion for approval of those minutes.
I'll move on that one too.
Any objections, requests for amendments, changes? Hearing none, without objection, the minutes from the December 13, 2010, House Subcommittee meeting are hereby approved. So, and the record should reflect that Tony Watt has joined us. Thank you. The next item on the agenda concerns election of committee chairs. There are four positions. As you may know, there are five public members. These positions can be held only by the public members on the committee. So there has been some discussion about who is willing to serve in those positions. And so with that, the first item concerns the Senate subcommittee chair. Skip Cook has indicated that he would be willing to serve if elected as the Senate subcommittee chair. And what that means, the way the law is set up, is that the whoever is the chair of the Senate subcommittee chairs the full committee in odd years, which would be, of course, this year. So from here on out, if he was elected, Skip would be the chair. The House chair of the House subcommittee chairs the full committee in even years, and that's the role that I've been fulfilling. So with that, Skip has indicated a willingness to serve. I would seek a nomination for the Senate subcommittee chair.
Yeah, I'd like to nominate, this is Gary Turner, I'd like to nominate Skip Cook for Senate subcommittee chair.
Any other nominations, objections to that? All right. With that, I think what we should probably do is vote on each one. Nominations are closed. Joyce, if you could take a roll call vote, please, for the
Senator Coghill.
Yes.
Tony Mallott.
Yes.
Senator Stevens.
Yes.
Gary Turner.
Yes.
Connor Thomas.
Yes.
Skip Cook.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, we have unanimous.
Okay, thank you. The next item is the vice chair of the Senate subcommittee. I've indicated that I'm willing to serve as the vice chair of the Senate subcommittee if nominated and approved, and so I would leave it at that.
I'll move the election.
Sure.
Skip.
Nomination?
Yes, I move nomination of Connor.
Any?
Seconded.
Okay. Any other? Hearing none, nomination cease, closed. Would ask for a roll call vote.
Skip Cook?
Yes.
Senator Coghill?
Yes.
Tony Mallott?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Connor Thomas?
Yes.
Gary Turner?
Yes.
The next is the House Subcommittee Chair. Herman Walker, who's not here, although he has been consulted, has indicated that he would be willing to serve as the chair of the House Subcommittee. So with that, I would seek a nomination for House Subcommittee Chair.
Yes, Gary Turner, I'd like to nominate Herman Walker as Senate Subcommittee Chair.
House
Subcommittee Chair.
Any other nominations? Seeing none, nomination cease. Joyce, we could take a roll call.
Skip Cook?
Yes.
Senator Coghill?
Yes.
Tony Mallott?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Gary Turner?
Yes.
Chair Thomas?
Yes. The last one is the vice chair of the House Subcommittee. Gary Turner has indicated a willingness to serve as the vice chair if nominated and elected. So with that.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Gary Turner be nominated as vice chair of the House Subcommittee.
Thank you. Any other nominations? Seeing none, nominations closed. Vote on nominations. Joyce, if you could call the roll, please, for the, this is vice chair of the House Subcommittee.
Gary Turner.
I don't believe I can vote.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
I abstain.
I was redoing my rotation here. Skip Cook.
Yes.
Senator Coghill.
Yes.
Tony Mallott.
Yes.
Senator Stevens.
Yes.
Chair Thomas.
Yes.
And Gary Turner.
Thank you, and we now have a new slate for the get us through the next couple of years. The next item on the agenda is public comment. I would ask if there's anyone who wishes to speak to the committee at this time. I would remind you that the chair has the option to limit discussion if time is short. With that, is there anyone wishing to speak to the committee? Nobody else is online. With that, we'll move on to the next part of the agenda, which is item 7, which is the chair and staff report. The first item, and this is in your packet, the yellow part, and the first item is ethics training for 2011, and this is informational only, and I would ask Joyce indicated that she would be willing to, of course, go over the report.
Chair and committee members, ethics training is mandatory this year, as I think everyone is aware of. So far, there have been 7 training classes conducted, 2 for legislators, some for support staff, some for new staff to legislators, and there are 2 more being conducted this week. The online training video has since been taken offline at this point since we're offering in-person training, but it will be put up later. There were actually no changes in statutory language in the last legislative session, so the online training video is still okay, so there will be no changes with that. The Standards of Conduct Handbook was updated with sections concerning newsletters and campaign issues that had come up during the last year. So it has been updated with that and a few other minor changes as well, which is why we're handing out a new one. It had to do with the decision that the House subcommittee issued on a complaint, decision H-1001 regarding newsletters, and then, of course, we had some questions that the committee has been discussing over the last umpteen years about, or seems like years, regarding campaigning and the use of state resources. So that was added into the handbook. I also prepared, which I handed out at ethics training class both yesterday and today for legislators, a handout called Communication with Constituents. It's really kind of focusing on newsletters, the do's and don'ts of what funds you can use, what the content is, what should not be in for campaigning, whether you can put voter registration information in it, and so forth. So that was handed out, as well as on the legislative travel and collateral campaign activities, and then on newsletters. So that those were the changes. And attached in your packet is the section that was added into the second page of the yellow, has added into the handbook regarding newsletters. And then the second one was the communication with constituents. So we have 2 more training classes this week. Training is tomorrow and Thursday for returning staff to the legislature. The statute reads that new staff shall have a basic course providing an understanding of the ethics code, whereas returning staff shall receive a review. So we're dividing the 2 classes up to a longer class and what I call an abbreviated class. So there are 2 abbreviated classes this week, and on February 1st and 3rd, we will be having an online housed out of the Anchorage LIO that is going to be a more extensive class, and it will cover both off-site individuals that are LIOs as well as staff that have legislators that have staff that are still in their home district, which are unable to attend the in-person training classes here. So it's kind of a dual-purpose class. So that will be February 1st and 3rd, like I said, and then we'll check to see who has not attended training and follow up from there. And I think that just about covers it with the training information, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, Joyce, with respect to that? One thing I will say is that during this past campaign season, we did get a lot of questions with respect to communication with constituents. Joyce answered a number of the concerns that various legislators had with respect to that issue. So it is something that people are definitely concerned about, and there have been complaints filed as a result of what some people do perceive to be inappropriate contact with constituents during campaign season. So at any rate, that's for your information. The next item is internship approval and update, which is the next yellow page in your packet.
The white page.
White page, I'm sorry, after the yellow page.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, would you like me to give a short report on that? Okay. Mr. Chair and committee members, internships are required to be approved by the Ethics Committee, and the second page of your white handout talks about the statute that addresses that. And the Ethics Committee, I believe it was in June of last year, came up with a procedure where the administrator, myself, would be able to approve internships after consulting with the chair of the Ethics Committee. And so since that time, we have had 4 internships approved. I believe it was in 2009, not 2010, that this procedure came up. And so the list of internships approved by the full ethics committee in 2007 and 9 are listed in your handout. And then this year, with the new procedure in place, both the chair, Connor Thomas, and myself reviewed internship background material for DePaul University, the Tlingit-Haida Tribal Vocational Rehabilitation Program, as well as IDEA, which is Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, and it's called Alaska Close-Up Program. And then also MAST, Mature Alaskan Seeking Skills Training, which is another intern program. So those four have been looked at. Notices went out to the committee members, which is required by statute, letting them know that we, Connor and I looked at these, the chair and I looked at these programs, and then we then sent out to all staff and legislators, letting them know that they had been approved. So my comment, I guess, at this time is I think the process has worked well. Prior to this, the full ethics committee had to meet, which could be difficult sometimes when the internship was something that was either had already started or wanted to start the following week, and it's sometimes difficult to get nine members together. So it has worked well. I think that the process between the chair and myself has worked, as well as the notification process sent out to all users. And so I just wanted to point out that it was a good change in the procedure for the committee that that allowed both the chair and myself to look at these and then make a determination, and if there were some questions, then we would have forwarded on to the rest of the committee.
Any questions of Joyce with respect to the issue? Seeing none, the next item concerns office purchases. Joyce, once again, will give you an update, really, on office equipment and supplies, and this is the next item in your packet, blue, I guess.
Mr. Chair and committee members, just wanted to report to the committee that in my time here with the Ethics Office since 2001, there have been very few purchases of office equipment. But this year it was felt, in addition to having a new staff person as well that's now permanent, the desks and everything that we had were what I call ancient and hand-me-downs and weren't really set up for computer access, which makes it difficult to sit at your desk for a long period of time and type and so forth. So we have since purchased a few things to make the office a little bit more ergonomic and friendly to the individual sitting there, and I think it's worked out quite well. So that's why we're reporting this.
Questions with respect to the office equipment or supplies? The next item is disclosures through December 30th. Office update, the next item.
Okay, Mr. Chair and committee members, I just wanted to report to the committee that we are in the process of what I call rolling out an electronic management activity log. It's an idea that I picked up at a COGO conference a couple years ago, hoping that that state would provide to us. Linda's going to hand out a handout of what it's going to look like. I was hoping that state would provide to us their program for free. They said at the conference they would, but have since revamped it and so forth, and it's just not forthcoming. So I worked with Curtis Clothier in our IS department, and they have assigned someone who is very familiar with Access to set up a program where when individuals call the ethics office, we can put in the information. And this has been brought up at the committee about 2 years ago and was not implemented, so we're finally doing it in-house. And so IS has been able to set up a program which will then allow us to run reports, come up with some statistics that might be helpful for the committee on, let's say, what kind of calls are coming in on a periodic basis. And so I'm really kind of excited about that. The staff report that's reported at each committee meeting takes a lot of time with Q&As. This is going to allow me to automatically type it in on a screen, and it will print that report for me. So I'm making my note at the time of the phone call, but it's also going to be used for the question and answer part. So I'm really excited about it. It's going to save me an extremely a lot of time trying to prepare that. So we're in the process. We're hoping to roll it out next week when we get back. Linda, my staff person, Linda Lay, and I are going to look at it. It's been a wonderful experience working with IS, and they have been very agreeable in what we're doing. Of course, we're not being charged for it, which is kind of nice because it's internal. But it is an Access program. So anyway, I wanted to just let you know that this is going to be available. These are a couple of the reports I ran off. So that you could see what is going to be in there. And I guess I'm open to answer any questions, but it's going to be a wonderful tool.
Any questions of Joyce with respect to the electronic management log?
Just one. First of all, I think it's a good idea. The program is something that you've been able to get your hands on. Is it something that the legislature is bringing to you access? I'm just curious.
The legislature is actually developing it for me.
Okay.
It's through Access, and there is a person in IS that is very familiar with Access, so she is actually developing the entire program, which is something, hopefully, I know that I have talked to APOC, and they're interested in something similar to that. They were going to wait and see what we did, but it's all internal, and it's basically what Linda and I have felt we want in it. It's a database. It's going to be a database that we're going to have. It's completely secure. It's going to be a password security. No one will have access to it. And Linda's going to have, my staff person is going to have a database with questions that she answers. I'm going to have one that I answer. She would not have access to mine, but we will be able to run reports and so forth. So it's going to be a wonderful management tool.
Gary?
Yes, a question to the legislators. Do you have similar database logs for constituent questions?
No, I don't think, not that I know of it, at least.
I had one at one time. This is Representative Tuck. Had one at one time. It was an access base as well, and it's also known as the Lucky database. And but we went to an online version now that helps us out much better.
Yeah, just this might be something to consider for your staff.
I mean, we just use the contacts, Microsoft Excel for our so. I have more calls from a few constituents and less calls from a lot of constituents, and so then that's how we categorize them under access.
And
they're
Mr.
Not access under under the Outlook.
And Mr. Chair, if I could comment, one other thing: it is searchable. So, in other words, if I receive a phone call from an individual and I know I've answered that question before, I might have looked in my staff report, which was kind of searchable by a document, doing a word. But this will be searchable, so if I know I answered a question regarding, let's say, the PFD fund, a constituent issue, or let's say, for example, I could search that and find out what that answer is. It will allow me to have a link to a Word document that I've sent to an individual so that I can easily pull that up. So it's just definitely going to be a resource as well.
So it's searchable by keywords?
Searchable by keywords. I've also put in there are certain categories that I have in the staff report, like, boards and commissions, gifts, and so forth. So we've set it up so that each call that comes in, you will have to pick a category to see what it is. So in other words, I could pull up, and as you can see on what was handed out, I can pull up all the calls that were received on gifts or on boards and commissions. So we've actually got it set up so that there's a list of some of, not all of them are on there, but a list so that they're going to be divided up by category as well. So I'm really excited about that. Because I can then run off all those that were campaign related, or I'll run those off that were boards and commission.
Are you going to backfill this with past calls that you've documented?
Oh, that's a wonderful idea.
Yeah.
I'm hoping to start with the beginning of this year, and past calls, no.
Any other questions? Any comments, Joyce?
And the only other thing I want to mention under the office update is that and now that I have a permanent staff person and she works Monday, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays, we are in the process, when we have time, which isn't very often, but we do have some time, of actually organizing and consolidating files, because the previous administrator may have had things in three or four files, but they weren't all complete. So now when I'm doing research, like I have for a couple issues on the agenda today, I have found some files, so we're ending up consolidating and organizing them. So I think it's another way that has helped with the office. So I'm just giving you some updates on what we're doing.
Any other comments on the electronic management or office update? Next item, 7E, which is disclosures through December 31 of 2008. This is in your packet, white page, late disclosures. Titled Late Disclosures, May 28th through January 19th, 2011. Joyce, I don't know if you have any comments on this or not. I guess it is what it is, right?
Right. We usually just report to the committee which ones are late disclosures. So there it is. I do want to say that Linda did a little analysis, which I alluded to in both the legislator training with what Senator Stevens has brought up about the 30 to 60-day gift disclosure requirement. And just for your information, in 2007, 13 of the 18 gift disclosures were late because of travel. So it's definitely there. And that was a campaign year. So there was travel there as well, but I'm kind of going back and forth. In 2009, there were 14 of 24. So we're looking at this last year, there were 5 of 14. So I guess what I'm saying is, in some years, there's sort of the majority of them are travel-related, so it definitely seems to be an issue with the 30 days, so I wanted to bring that up at this point.
Okay, we'll get to the 30-day issue a little bit later. The next item is part of the same thing, which is a comparison that has been put together with respect to APOC and ethics disclosures. It's the next item in the packet, and once again, Joyce will give you a report with respect to the comparison.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the reason I put this together is because this is the first year that we've really had, APOC has had staff, and this office has had staff to kind of do a comparison of APOC filings by legislators and also APOC filings on the ethics side. There are three areas that require dual filing. One is the close economic association, one is the contract and leases, and then the other one is membership on a board. They're required on your financial disclosure, but then they're also required on the ethics end. And they have different requirements on both sides. So I've sort of put a little analysis together to let you know. And on the second page, just kind of put down the general reasons for reporting. You're probably wondering why there's dual reporting, but APOC is everything to do with financial, so that's why it's required there. And on our end, there are certain disclosures, and we're more timely on our end because they're filed within a 30-day time period versus APOC is the previous year, and it's for that calendar year, and then it isn't filed again. So if you were to wonder, you know, why is there the dual filing? One is the financial side, and then one is what I would term is more timely on our side, and it's ongoing. So if you have a board membership in March, you need to file it by April within 30 days. So I guess my point is that APOC and ethics have started to work together more so than they have in the past, and I did take a look at the disclosures, as you see here, and there were some reported on their side, some not on our side, and going back and forth and so forth. So I've tried to mention at all training classes that there is this dual reporting, and we'll see what happens with this particular go-around with the financial disclosures. But it definitely is a dual requirement, and I guess I don't see any way to get around that because one's financial and one's more on this side. But anyway, I thought it was important to point that out, and I probably will be sending something out again, just reminding legislators that there is the dual filing requirement so that they're aware of it.
Mr. Chairman, that is helpful.
Any other comments with respect to the comparison between APOC and ethics disclosures? And as you'll see later on the agenda, we're going to discuss the possibility of having at least an informational meeting with APOC. And these items that have been addressed here would be part of that discussion, I think. The next item is... concerns the website update, and Joyce is talking here about the Ethics Committee website, and there have been some changes made, which she'll relay to.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we now have a calendar on our website, so you can pull up the calendar and see what reporting requirements there are or anything else. More so dates in a campaign year or election year than now with prohibitions and so forth. So that's new on the website. We've also included, as you'll see on the first in your sort of a buff-colored page, we have included that if you want to receive copies of our ethics newsletter when you pull it up online, that you just need to click here and you can subscribe, because I have had people ask, and we have had some people added to the list, like, well, previously was the state of Washington. They're on the list, the ethics director. NCSL is on our list. You know, a few other states, and I usually get some comments back from that. Oh, you're doing that. You know, so I mean, back to our discussion with legislators, I'm sort of getting an exchange between some other states that are picking up our newsletter and what they do. So I think it's been very helpful. We've also added an advisory opinion explanation, which wasn't on there before. So now if someone wants to request an advisory opinion, I just refer them to the website. We also, based on our June meeting, we now have an audio of our committee meetings on BASIS for 2010, and we're working on it for other years because it hasn't been on BASIS. So hopefully we're going to get 2009 and, of course, this year as well. So those are some of the things we're working on. Also, when I was going through files and organizing, there was a history of the Ethics Committee started at one time, so there's been a couple updates on that, and hopefully at some time we're going to get on the website the history of the Ethics Committee and legislation, which I think will be helpful for anyone that wants to look at it. So that's something that was very briefly worked on during the summer when there were a few moments. So there's been a lot of things going on in the Ethics Office, and, again, I felt it was important to update the committee.
Have you gotten any newsletters from other states?
I've actually pulled up newsletters from other states. I haven't seen a subscribe, you know, to subscribe to them, but I periodically pull up Washington State and Hawaii. I like the way they have their newsletters set up, and I haven't actually seen any for subscribe, but that's a good idea. If I might want to see if I can pick some up.
Any other questions with respect to the website? The next item on the agenda is informal advice. Joyce had indicated that there wasn't adequate time to prepare. Normally, we would have for you a list of the informal advice that she's given. People have the chance to go through and take a look at that. Sometimes there's been questions raised about whether or not the outcome was correct or not correct. At any rate, that will be completed, and all committee members will get a copy of the updated informal advice report that Joyce has given. The next item, 7H, is campaign period oversight activities. This is an informational discussion item. Joyce will go over the report, and then we'll see where we go from there.
This year during the campaign season, again, because of having staff on board, I think the Ethics Office is becoming more proactive than reactive. So we were able to look at the campaign sites, at least the ones we could find, and right at the beginning of the session, or actually it was more like a notice on February 4th we sent out, but check to make sure that the legislative campaign websites did not have what we call contribute language on their website, which is prohibited during a legislative session. And we did find 9 sites that still contained that information, so we notified those legislators to go ahead and remove it. 4 removed it immediately. The office alerted the 5 others a week later because they had not removed it. So it definitely was something that should not have been there. And as I say under the note here, this certainly was an area where a legislator could have received a complaint that they had that they were soliciting contributions during a campaign season. One legislator felt that he had said, would you like to make a campaign contribution, and then said, please note, campaign contributions will not be accepted during the legislative session. Thank you. That's similar to what we have said in an advisory opinion regarding the use of, you know, legislative resources, contact information, even though you put the disclaimer in there, and that was also has come up recently in a couple complaint cases where even though you have that disclaimer that still is there and it's still making either the solicitation or providing that information. So I did check with the chair on how to proceed, and we did send a letter to the legislator and pointing out that the statute says solicit or accept and not solicit and accept, which is really a totally different meaning. And as I say here, the act of soliciting is separate from the act of accepting a contribution, so the legislator did remove that language. There were actually 9 legislators, as I said, that, you know, someone certainly could have filed an ethics complaint. So hopefully we're, like I said, being a little bit more proactive. The letter of intent and campaign registration form, we notified legislators that they shouldn't have their legislative contact information on there because those are documents that the public look at to call candidates. And so they were notified to remove that. 17 legislators had legislative contact information on these forms. seven had it both on the letter and registration, four on the letter, and six on the registration form. And so they all did change that information. And under another section, which is actually the next one, if we want to just maybe jump to that one real quick,
sure,
Mr.
Ahead,
Chair.
I mean,
working with APOC, it's the purple handout. Working with APOC, they have now changed their letter of intent form. They now say to sitting legislators that they should not put that information on, so it's just a heads up. So our bodies, APOC and Ethics, are working very closely together. And then on the next page of the purple one is the candidate registration. They also say the same thing. So they have noticed, they have made changes over there so that you are alerted when you fill out the form that you shouldn't do that. So that's worked quite well.
Mr. Chairman, and I got caught up in this. It didn't even dawn on me when I was filling out a APOC registration. When they want to know what my office phone number is, I put my office phone number down. It didn't even dawn on me that that would be unethical at all. I can see why we wouldn't do that, but, I mean, that's my office phone number. So they ask for my home and my office, I put it down. So it's really good that they put that kind of language on their form, because I appreciate the proactiveness of the APOC and the Ethics Committee. They called me on it. We took it off. But I don't have any other office phone number, so that was my reasoning behind it, and it didn't even dawn on me that it might be improper.
The third area that the Ethics Office took some action was on campaign websites also containing legislative contact information. And in that one, we noticed that, you know, with the campaign contribution language and this one, we notified them, and in February 4th, really did not follow up again after that. But in September, we reviewed all the campaign websites, and I worked with the chair on this, and this was a little had a lot of discussion where we had, well, not quite. Four legislators had legislative contact information on their campaign website via either a link to their legislative newsletter or by directly pasting their newsletter with the legislative contact information on the campaign website, and then all four legislators did remove it. So that was, and then, of course, in November, we had the complaint filed against Representative Lynn for having legislative contact information on his campaign website, which the House subcommittee did issue a decision in December. So those are some of the areas that we actually did some follow-up and hopefully helped some legislators to let them know that they shouldn't have that information on their website.
Any comments from anyone concerning the campaign issue and websites? Seeing none, the next item was the APOC forms, which we just went over.
We have one more APOC form, Mr. Chair, if I can say. If you want to turn to the third page of your APOC form, or the purple colors, I mean. This was a question that came from me. The last 2 years, legislators have been calling our office when their financial disclosure is due and saying, you know, I didn't keep a copy of all my gift disclosures. Can you send them to me? And my question would be, why? And they said, well, I need to file it with my APOC form. I didn't think anything of it the first year, but then the second year it happened, I actually questioned APOC as to why the gift disclosures were required. And we did some research and found out that APOC changed their complete forms and didn't realize that legislators do not need to file their gift disclosures on your APOC form. It's not a requirement. It's actually, there was a lot of history in legislative committee meetings and in language and so forth. And so APOC has since taken that off of their form. So I think this is a good way to say that the two agencies, again, are working together and questioning maybe each other as to why. And like I said, it hadn't been, the whole time I'd been there, they had never, no one had ever required their gift disclosures. I couldn't figure out, there was no statutory change. So we have since, they now have, if you'll see where I put the asterisk or the star, where it says public filers, public official filers only, legislative filers are not required to fill in this section, which is gifts, more than 250. So you're no longer required to provide that, which I think is a very good idea. Like I said, I didn't know why it was anyway. So we have resolved that issue, which I think is less work on your side when you have to file your financial disclosure that you no longer need that. And then, as you can see on the back side here, they have it as well, where you do not need to fill in this section. So these are gifts worth more than $250. So they've actually put it in two different spots, in the instructions and then on the actual form.
Andrew? Yeah, I do appreciate that. The two agencies are working together and not requiring duplication. If there were other areas other than gifts where both agencies required the same information, is there a sharing of what people give APOC as to what they give you? Can APOC request information of you? Can you request information of them? And the reason I ask that is maybe there are other areas that you both need to have that information, but in fact, it just seems life is always simpler to me if you know you can get the information somewhere, you don't need to collect it or file it or keep it. You can always find it. So the question is, can you share information back and forth between the two agencies?
Well, Senator Stevens and committee members, we do share information. I think you're talking more about maybe what's required statutorily, you know, which they require and we require. We share information a lot, so we're actually going back and forth. We are required by statute every time a staffer, for instance, one instance, whereas if a staffer files that they have a lobbyist spouse, they're required to file that with us. We're required by statute to forward that to them, so we do, you know, so they have that information. So there is definitely a sharing of information. And back to what I said earlier about the dual filing on the three particular areas, I'm not sure that can be changed because APOC is all financial. But on our end, we're all the public's right to know and timeliness. And so we require disclosures within 30 days of any time something changes, whether it be a close economic association, membership on a board, or if you're having a contract, you know, with the state. Whereas when you file your financial disclosure, it's really the previous year, and so it's not what I would call real current. You know, so I guess I'm not seeing any way those two can be changed other than the fact to alert all of you as legislators. But I think there might be other areas to look at as we go down the road.
Well, in time we can find ways to simplify it, and our goal, again, is not gotchas. It's to get the information and make sure that it's available. Thank you.
Any other comments with respect to the...
Just one other comment, Mr. Chairman. Sure. The ethics newsletter is one of those constant reminders. So if you haven't got on it, and I would encourage everybody, in fact, I should have said that at the ethics training meeting, to get on board of that because it's just a reminder. I've traveled, I've done things and totally forgot because my staff did all of the travel arrangements, and then I just lost track of keeping track of things and usually thought about it at 11 o'clock at night. But sometimes it's the ethics committee that kind of jogs my brain for the 30-day reporting issue. Just a kudos.
Any other comments with respect to that? Well, the next item is similar. It's a discussion item of a proposed meeting with APOC on the overlapping issues or areas in which the two bodies operate. That's the next item in your agenda, and Joyce is kind of outlined in there. The areas that she feels that include overlapping either responsibilities or where the decisions between the two bodies have either come into conflict or join one another. So the question for the committee is, I think, whether or not it's a good idea to schedule a joint meeting with APOC. If so, when and topics of discussion. So I would just throw that out to see if there's an interest in doing that. I don't know that we need to necessarily schedule the meeting at the moment because we haven't talked to APOC, but I'm assuming we're talking about sometime after session. So.
Mr. Chairman, probably talking too much, but I think after session is a good idea because the consequence of laws changing affects both bodies, and in 1 year you might have significant changes in the APOC reporting or vice versa, or if they happen simultaneously and they don't fit real well, first of all, we'll be alert to it during the session, but if it lands in such a way that those communications have to happen, that's going to be one of the ways that legislators find out if they do or don't work. Sometimes we can't see it coming, but if we can see it coming, I think it's a good idea to have the conversation beforehand But at least after session, that's a chance to say, okay, what was actually passed in the law that either works well or how do we have to work because of that? So I think at least one meeting a year after a session is probably wise. And that would be probably a July meeting, I would think, or August meeting. What do we? Yeah, no.
I was just wondering, this is Skip, just an inquiry. Are you thinking about having the entire both bodies meet together, or staff and chairs try to get together for a meeting? If we're talking about summer, I can just see a terrible time trying to get the two full bodies together.
Yeah, well, I think that's really that's what we're discussing. Nobody's made that call yet with respect to
I think we probably have. It might be more successful to have a smaller group representing both bodies meet than to try to get the whole. I'm not sure how many are on their committee.
There's five.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts or? Yeah, that sounds reasonable to me.
Well, yeah, I understand what you're saying, and I think the overlapping issues are probably pretty limited. I mean, you know what they are. This the only time where you get all the legislators in the same place is during session, and I'm wondering if I just wondering off the top of my head whether it'd be an advantage to meeting when the legislature is in session if you could find a time when everyone could attend a meeting and say, I mean, I don't know all the problems. Overlapping may be a difficulty, but maybe other legislators do have issues that they would like to bring. And you certainly can't get all the legislators together in Anchorage. I mean, that would just not happen. So I don't know. Just a question. Would there be any advantage in having an opportunity for legislators to meet with both bodies and say this is an overlapping issue?
Yeah, legislators.
Question for Joyce. This is Gary Turner. How long of a meeting do you think this might be? Is it an hour, two, four? And the reason I ask is perhaps the next time the Ethics Committee has a meeting that we tack it on the end or beforehand. In case it does occur in Anchorage, then you still have to be there and kill two birds with one stone.
No, I'm not necessarily talking about myself. I'm talking about other legislators.
Right.
Not John or myself or Tuck, but others who may have an opinion. But maybe not. Maybe that wouldn't be an issue. I don't know. What do you think, Joyce?
Senator Stevens, the committee members, while we're talking, have two suggestions. One is possibly have a meeting with APOC with just, you know, maybe their staff and the chair and, you know, a few of us and sort of flush out some things and talk about whatever issues we think we are before we would have a meeting, maybe what you're suggesting. And then that way the discussion wouldn't be bogged down with sort of little things, you know, and then that way you could talk about what I call more the bigger issues or what legislators might think are the bigger issues. So maybe that's the route to go, is have a preliminary meeting and then invite legislators and then have both Ethics and APOC there, you know, for discussion and so forth. I think that might work better. And then looking at a time frame, I don't know. I guess, you know, as you well know, even with our training classes we've had these last 2 days, it really depends on questions and, you know, and everything else. But I think maybe a preliminary meeting first to sort of not set some ground rules, but, you know, talk to each other, get familiar with the two bodies, get familiar with each other, I mean, and then have an open meeting.
And you're really talking about a meeting with all the legislators as opposed to the ones that are just on the committee, right? So that's...
And that could only occur during session, so we're not talking probably this session.
Yeah, no, I see.
And Mr. Chairman, I envisioned the Ethics Committee meeting with the APOC Commission, and I'm open if a smaller group that are the people have to work with the details come up with an agenda item that is important, then I think we could do that. I don't know that we have to meet just to meet, though. But if there are agenda items that could be addressed that could either clarify roles or show overlap or tension within those roles, then I would be willing to meet. But unless we have those things real obvious where we need to have that communication, I don't know that we need a meeting to have a meeting.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could make one other comment. as I said in the handout, there's been two advisory opinions that have been issued this year that really related both to ethics and APOC. And so I worked closely with APOC on that one with Senator Stevens' request. And then another one was from Representative Guerra that had to do with a website. But, you know, they sort of overlapped between the two, or at least they called for information and we provided information. I guess I was looking at a meeting where we could say, let them know what our mode of operation is, which is different than theirs, and so that we're kind of not aware of each other and how they operate, and sort of have a preliminary meeting that would cover that. There's also been one complaint this year that a complaint was filed with us as well as with APOC. So, again, they were overlapping. You see what I mean? So we've had quite a few areas right now that have, and there was one previous one that have overlapped, and so I just thought it would be maybe beneficial to have that meeting, to have a discussion and say, hey, we're going to work with you, and, are you going to work with us, and that sort of a thing, and sort of just open up the line of communication, I guess is where I'm coming from. Not that it's not there, but make it better.
I think you're saying absolutely correctly. I think it's just the right way to go. But I do see the advantage of bringing the legislature in maybe next session and having an opportunity to meet directly with you and with APOC. I'm always surprised when I go to these training sessions. Like yesterday, I went to the one, and there were a lot of questions from a lot of legislators and things that I had not heard before, and I suspect things that Joyce had not heard before, because she had to say, well, I'll have to look that up. I'll have to figure that out. I'll have to talk to someone. So who knows what issues may lie out there that we have not even considered, that I haven't considered, and you haven't considered. And so even though it's pretty far forward thinking, next session in January through March, it'd be nice if we could think about maybe having some kind of a joint session with APOC here in Juneau with all legislators available.
Yeah, Gary Turner. Senator Stevens, does APOC do any training for legislators similar to ethics?
I don't think so. I don't recall.
Mr. Chairman, they send us a manual, but sometimes we have to go looking for it.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond for a second. APOC is required, as we are, to conduct lobbyist training before they can register, but I'm not aware of, in the time that I've been here, and it's almost 10 years, that they've ever had any training with legislators.
However, Mr. Chairman, they have been proactive in the last few years, which has been very helpful. Instead of waiting until there's a penalty, I've actually been called, you forgot a page, when you faxed it, stuff like that, so, which I've done.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could just add, they're fully staffed as well, which I think makes a big difference when they're dealing with that type of an issue.
Joyce, have you talked to anybody from APOC?
No, Mr. Chair, I did not. I was waiting to see what the committee feeling was before I actually approached it. I have mentioned it to the Juno administrator, who isn't here this week, but to the Juno administrator, and she thought it was a good idea. And so I don't believe she shared it with the director. I don't know if you are aware, but Holly Hill, the executive director, is resigning February 1st. So I think they're sort of in a, I don't want to say a flux, but they're waiting to see what they're going to happen. So I just didn't feel it was appropriate to talk to Holly because she's no longer going to be there.
And do they meet on a schedule of some sort?
Yes, they do. They meet, I believe they meet every 3 months, and they have three-day meetings. So their meeting, I don't think it's this week. I think they're meeting next week, and I think they might be here in Juneau.
They must look over everybody's report.
They do. They do go over all the...
Just yours. Yeah.
Well, is there a consensus developing at all with respect to this? I mean, it sounds like people seem to think it's a pretty good idea. I mean, maybe the way to leave it is to have Joyce talk with the APOC and see if they are interested. And then, assuming they are, we could at least proceed with some preliminary contact with them, with Joyce and two or three other people from the committee that might be interested, assuming there's somebody from APOC, and then bring it up at the next meeting. Does that seem reasonable? Any objection to proceeding like that? Okay. The next item is vacancies for 2011, and there are no public member terms expiring this year. The next item is a report on attendance, COGL conference, which was attended by Joyce and Berta Gardner and Herman also, right?
That's correct. Mr. Chair, it was, and Herman isn't here today, and Representative Gardner was unable to attend, but the COGL conference in Washington, D.C. was well attended. There were quite a few sections on ethics, and the overall feeling I picked up from the conference regarding ethics is that there are some states that are still in what I would call the throes of proposing ethics legislation based on issues that have come up in their state, similar to what happened in our state with the FBI indictments. So they're in that type of a mode. There are those that are in more like a slowdown mode where, you know, there is no ethics legislation. And so it seemed to be just really depending on the current events that are going on in a particular state. There was a section on ethics enforcement, how to make it work, which I did attend. And that had to do pretty much with what we actually did this summer or this campaign year with notifying legislators. A lot more ethics committees are being not just waiting for things to happen. They're actually going out there and being more proactive, which was good to hear. So they talked about some of the things that we've done, maybe not necessarily in the campaign area, but in areas where they feel they're more of an information person, they're having more contact with legislators. Some of them didn't have newsletters. Now they do, you know. So, I mean, I think we're a little bit ahead of the game there. So there were some suggestions about that. I did attend a session called Engaging the Public Through Social Networks, which I have to admit was way over my head, very technical. I am not on Facebook. I am not on Twitter. I am not on MySpace. I know my daughter is, and I've checked them out. But so I felt it was kind of over my head. I don't feel I picked up too much from that. It does seem to be the mode that a lot of states are going into the social network areas. They're all testing the waters. No one really talked about what they've done other than the fact that they feel it is, what's a good word? I don't want to say scary, but that's kind of what I got from it. It's a brand new field, and they're not sure where it's going to go. And they had some, like I said, some technical people there, and I was just sitting listening, like I said, way over my head. So I'm not sure I can really report anything on that one other than it is a topic, and it sounds like it's going to be a topic at the next conference, which is coming up at the end of this year, which actually is in Nashville, I mentioned. Thought it was in a different city, but it's in Nashville. And so they're saying that the room was packed. They had to bring in extra chairs. I mean, it was a very well-attended one. And like I said, it was more technical people. And so that's about all I can say on that one. We did have... Yes.
Are you saying that there may be some ethical issues in legislators using Facebook?
That's what they brought up, yes.
It's a real timely thing for us to discuss because we have now engaged staff, hired people to help us move into Facebook because many states around the country, legislators are using that, and we have not allowed it through ledge council, through the state system, but I think that's a consideration that will be occurring very shortly here, and I would suspect that it's going to pass because others are doing it, and a lot of legislators are saying I'm going outside, not using the state system in order to do this on my own, so it might be a really appropriate time for us to try to come up to speed. Are there ethical issues that legislators should be aware of and be wary of?
Well, I think the session was basically it was a company that had come in and talked about social networking and so forth, and there was a little fringe discussion about more of the ethical issues that might come up, and I know one of them that wasn't really addressed very well. I mean, it was just sort of, like I said, on the fringe was campaigning. You know, how do you prevent, you know, campaign information from being on, let's say, Facebook or whatever? I think the most of it dealt with the other end of it versus that, but they did mention that as well. And I'm grasping here for some information of which I can't recall. I'll have to check my notes back at the office on that particular one. But I certainly can get a hold of Kogel and find out, you know, if they have any type of policies in any other states or anything like that that I could get to you. Because
I think that we, if we do a legislatively sponsored Facebook, the prohibition would be the same as on your newsletters. You simply cannot use it for, you cannot even mention campaigning. You can't mention campaign sites, and yes, I would think it'd be the same thing. So.
And I think that was the major focus of what they thought was more of an ethical issue than anything else. But let me get a hold of Kogel and find out if they have any studies. Or we're also able, as the Ethics Committee is a member of Kogel, which for those of you that don't know, it's the Council on Governmental Ethics Laws, we can certainly put in a question and then people can respond to it. I haven't done that, but we can do that. And so let me see if I can pick up some information. And Representative Gardner, and I'll check with Representative Gardner and Herman Walker. I'm not sure they attended this particular one because I think I might have been the only one there because we're all trying to split up which ones we were going to. But I'll double check with them and see if they were at that one.
Yeah, question for Joyce. Maybe when you ask that, Gary Turner, is the potential for legislators having a legislative Facebook site and then a campaign Facebook site? Because that's, you know, we talked about this with a past complaint. I think that's where the grayness is going to get really wide. Because if you have somebody send you a post a note on your Facebook site and said, okay, Gary, when's your next fundraiser? Well, you want to respond, but it doesn't have a legislative purpose, you're in a quandary.
Exactly right, Gary, and that's going to be an issue. But like for legislators, for senators, with a four-year term, you've got, 4 years with no campaigning at all. And that could make it very clear that you would be using a Facebook, state-sponsored Facebook with no campaigning. But then when you get into the campaign mode, you've got to establish another system, just like we do with cell phones.
Well, what was the reason that it wasn't allowed, initially?
We had some legislators who were probably throwbacks to the crocodile stage, and I don't know. I mean, there were really a concern. Many of us were not aware of what is happening in those newer systems, and a fear that we might get into trouble by sponsoring it through the state. So I think there's just a lack of interest and some opposition to us trying to do that.
I was on Ledge Council, Mr. Chairman. When we discussed it, there was three major issues. One of them was bandwidth, just what we could do here in the legislature. Secondly was there was no state-sponsored anything, so it was just an individual site. And then the question of the ethical problem of what do they use it for? Do they use it for campaigning? Do they use it for other contacts? And there was appropriateness of information that would come in as well as go out. So those are some of the questions. And then the other thing was staff time, that you might have somebody spending a lot of time drawing time, pay for doing legislative work, who's actually doing Facebook time or whatever the other one is. So those were the three major concerns. And we really shut it down based on the time in the office because we didn't know what that commodity would be, how to control it. And then bandwidth was another issue. So if they're going to do a state-sponsored one, then it's easier to put limitations on what could go out. But I can tell you, you're going to have a hard time limiting what could come in.
Yeah, you can't.
I think the reality is that things are changing, and many of our constituents communicate by Facebook, and that's maybe it. And so if you as a legislator are going to be talking to your constituents and want to get input and let them know what's going on, not in a campaign mode, but just as a constituent service, I think many states are realizing that they really have got to be involved in these social networking systems or miss the boat.
Mm-hmm. Hi, this is Tony Malott, and the one benefit about Facebook is they let you know whose birthday is coming up this month, so that would be the nice social benefit of that.
That's right.
Joyce, anything else from the conference? Or
One other thing I just wanted to mention, there was a speaker for one of the luncheons from England, which was rather very interesting. He was an ethics administrator, and I sat there and listened to him and just was thankful that I was here in the state of Alaska in the United States. He was the ethics administrator, and he actually had death threats, and he was talking about, some corruption that was going on, and it was his wife got fired from her job because of his job, and it was we were all sitting there kind of with our mouths open, going, my goodness gracious, you know. So I guess my point is, if we think ethics has been in the limelight here, it sounds like it's been much more so in England.
Could you tell how Alaska seems to be stacking up with their ethics law compared to other states?
They had what they called roundtable discussions. So if you got up early, of which I'm not a morning person, but I did, got up early to go to these roundtable discussions for breakfast, you could pick whatever topic you wanted. And one of the topics that I picked was that I sat at one morning had to do with the effectiveness of your ethics program and so forth. And each one really kind of has their own feeling. I felt, based on the discussion, that we are actually doing very well. There are some that are in the, maybe they have just been created and they're in the initial stages, you know, because their state has just decided they need a new ethics body. So they were there trying to gather information, you know, pick people's brains on, you know, how other agencies work. But I felt by the discussion that I feel we're kind of way ahead of the game. They also felt and I'm trying to think of what some of the states were that I sat with, and I can't right at the moment, but when I would talk about the makeup of our ethics committee, you know, that we're made up of public members and legislators, that's kind of unique to some people, because a lot of them are just legislators overseeing legislators. And so they felt that, of course, I pushed our committee really well, too. But they felt that the way the ethics committee was set up in Alaska, they felt probably would work well in their state because it was a combination of the two. So, and I think it didn't come up at the conference, but if my recollection is right, I think there's only three or four states that are set up like we are. And Washington State is one, and I have corresponded with Washington State. They're actually, their statute is very similar to ours. He didn't happen to be at this conference, but I've actually talked to him before. But, yeah, I think we're ahead of the game.
Comments? Is that it for the conference?
Yes.
Okay. The next item is publication of advisory opinions and complaint decisions. And Joyce notes in here that the booklets have been distributed to all legislative offices and LIOs, and I assume that means booklets of the advisory opinions.
And complaints.
And complaints, and to the legislative library. It's noted here that the Senate read the decision into the record on Tuesday, and the House will do so on Friday. The next item is the state benefit and loan program. As most of you know that have served for any length of time on the committee, that we're required to review this periodically. The determination that the committee needs to make is whether or not something should be reported or not reported if it's part of a state benefit or loan program. There are guidelines in the the statutory provisions that outline when a program must be reported and when it is not. And so every year, Joyce sends out a letter to determine whether or not the list should be changed. And so with that, she'll go over the report that you have, and this is the sort of the gray-colored part of your packet.
Mr. Chair and committee members, letters were sent out, as the chair said, to all state departments. We had the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities respond back that the Alaska Cooperative Transportation and Public Facilities Research Program no longer exists, so we have removed that from the list. I see down here that I put approve the deletion, but I don't think the committee really needs to approve a deletion because it's a deletion, not an addition or a change. And that was the only change. The Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development had responded that they really wanted to delete all of the programs under the divisions of banking, securities, and corporations, and then also just the one under division of banking and securities. So if you look at like the fourth gray handout, you will see that that's at the bottom of that page. I told Ms. Jo Ellen Hanrahan, I believe I'm pronouncing her name right, that she needed to provide documentation to us as to why she wanted to delete them. And I have not received that. But as you can see, I did a little history in the letter that's attached here. And there was one that was removed in 1996 that was really never taken off the list, so we did take that off. I don't know what happened there. That was before my time. It must have just been an error that we didn't remove it, but it was removed by committee minutes. And then I told her that the very last two gray pages, and on page two of the last two gray pages, I took information out of the minutes and told her why that one particular program was put in there and the reasons for it, and sent that to her and waited for her to respond. I have not heard anything other than the fact that this is like the second time they've requested it. They had requested it one other time and didn't respond. So I guess at this point, Mr. Chair, I would say until we get some documentation as to why they want to remove those programs, I would make the recommendation that the committee do nothing, but I wanted you to be aware of the fact that, that they have actually requested to have this removed.
Any comments with respect to paid benefit and loan review? Any objection to proceeding along the line suggested by Joyce, which is basically leave it alone, which would require the continued reporting? Seeing none, I'll move on to the next item, which is rules of procedure. And there have been a number of suggestions that Joyce has made. She's gone through the procedures, the committee's rules of procedures, and in some cases felt that they didn't comply with either the statutory provisions or weren't clear enough. And so she's suggested a number of items. The first item concerns meetings notice. It really has to do with reconsideration, I think, and of a vote. And so with that, I'll let Joyce. Well, she's indicated that this did come up fairly recently after a vote that was taken on one of our favorite topics, which is the travel and campaigning issue. And shortly thereafter, one of the members that was actually an alternate who sat on the committee asked to reconsider his vote. And the procedures that we've been operating under really don't have a method to do that. And so, you know, I was acting chair at the time, so sort of cobbled together what I thought was a reasonable response based on Robert's rules and how other bodies respond to those, and then proceeded along those lines. So, but that, I think, brought home at least to those of us who were on the committee at the time that it's probably a good idea to have something in our procedures which relate to reconsideration of a vote, which we haven't really. And then Joyce, in a method I'm sure that she'll explain, but somehow stumbled upon research and suggestions that were done in years prior by the committee before any of those that sit now were active with the committee. And so this had been an issue before for reasons that we were unaware of. It didn't make its way into the rules of procedure. And so I think that her suggestion that you have contained in your packet here is that the committee consider adopting the work that was done by a previous committee with respect to this particular issue. So with that, Joyce, if you have anything to add?
No, I think maybe it might be important to go over, if you want to go over that, Mr. Chair, or go over what is recommended in the.
Well, why don't you go ahead then, since you put it together.
Okay, Mr. Chair and committee members, put together some information. I took most of the information from what the committee had already discussed and then, of course, looked at the Uniform Rules of Procedure and Mason's Manual and Robert's Rules of Order. And then APOC has recommending some rules for recommendation, so I included them for your information as well. But put on page 2 of the white, we've got page 2 of 42, that motions must be stated in the positive. Positive, that was never in the rules. Excuse me. The statute says that a majority vote of the members appointed to the committee or a subcommittee is required for official action. That's taken right from statute. So I'll suggest putting that in the rules of procedure. And then reconsideration of a vote. There may be what, one reconsideration. Once the question is called for, the previous vote is canceled. The notice of intent to file a motion for reconsideration may only be given by a member who participated in the vote on which the notice is being given. And then if all members of the committee or subcommittee participated in it, only those on the prevailing side may give notice. If less than a complete committee or subcommittee and the motion failed, any member may give notice. And if the motion passed, only a prevailing member may give notice. So so those are some of the areas. The notice to reconsider was really divided into three areas of the Ethics Committee operation. One is advisory opinions, one was administrative matters, and the other one is complaint proceedings. And felt that there should be really three different ways to look at a notice of reconsideration depending on what the committee was voting on. With advisory opinions, the notice of reconsideration may be given based on a showing of either procedural error, fraud, misrepresentation, material mistake of fact or law, or new evidence relevant to the opinion within 2 working days, and then the committee has to meet within 30 days. And, of course, any action taken by the person requesting the advisory opinion prior to the reconsideration is not subject to any action by the committee because they were following what the committee put forth. So that's on the advisory opinion, so within 2 working days for those reasons. For the complaint proceedings, it suggests that we're on page 8, under E. Page 3, and then D, where it said advisory opinions. And then E, now complaint proceedings, that the notice of reconsideration must be given prior to the adjournment of the meeting at which the vote was taken, and then the reconsideration must take place at the same meeting unless additional clarifying information is needed. And then if it is, then and the chair makes that determination, then the meeting must be scheduled within 30 days. Now, for administrative matters, I suggested there was no suggested time frame, I don't think, or maybe there was in here. I suggested 2 working days, but really any time frame could be determined there as well. The uniform rules extend the time frame to 1 legislative day. That one's saying the notice of reconsideration may take either place prior to the adjournment of the meeting in which the vote was taken or within whatever the committee decides. And then if it's prior to adjournment, it must be taken up within 30 days. Unless 2/3 of the full membership vote to reconsider at the same meeting. And then after adjournment, the timeliness of the motion to reconsider will be determined by the chair. That's basically what Chair Thomas did the last time. And this is this actually has been put in here when I checked with our LAA legal department on issues that had come up. And these were some of the things that they mentioned was the motion has not been acted upon, the minutes have not been officially approved, and the next regularly scheduled meeting has not occurred. So those are, and that's quite a bit to take all at once. So I don't know if you want to take up like advisor opinions, complaint proceedings, administrative matters separately and have discussion or what, but a lot of it came from the 97 information that was in the file, and then a couple, some of it is new based on the reconsideration request that was made in June of last year.
Which parts are the new parts, do you recall?
Well, here is the reconsideration of a vote. They've got administrative matters, advisory opinions, and complaints. Sort of put it in a different format. The information, the one on the bottom where it says after adjournment where the motion has not been acted upon on the very bottom of page 3, that's information that I received from legal when we had discussed how to handle a motion of reconsideration. So that's pretty new. Otherwise, the rest of the stuff is pretty much in there from before about prior to adjournment in the meeting and so forth. So I would say it's mostly from 97, a little bit of a combination of the recent situation.
This is Skip. I don't understand what's meant by under 3B. Once the question is called for, what do you mean once the question is called for? Do you mean once the notice of reconsideration is given?
Yes.
Okay, well, I think that's what it should say then.
Okay.
Because the question being called for, that sounds like you're voting on something.
Okay, once
now,
the
I would suggest also that those A, B, and C be renumbered so that C is A is B, and B is C. I just think it should stay first who can file, you know, notice of intent to file a motion for litigation may be given by a member. I think that should be the first thing. And then maybe there can only be one vote should be second, and then once notice is given, previous vote is canceled should be the third.
While we're on that,
go ahead,
Connor. It's always very confusing once you get into these rules, and maybe you need one of our resident attorneys to think about this, but I can understand why a motion that we have taken action and it's passed, and somebody wants to reconsider it. I guess I don't quite understand why you want to reconsider the motion that failed. You can always make a motion again as time passes. I mean, normally what I've seen happen, and maybe the attorney, one of the attorneys can answer this, most of what I've seen happen is that some action is taken and then it's reconsidered. Seems a little odd that action is not taken and you reconsider it. Skip, does that make sense to you? Are there times where something could happen, you'd fail a motion and then you want to reconsider?
I think people that give notice for reconsideration have to be on the prevailing side.
Right.
They have to vote on the prevailing side to start with.
So that would not be a motion that failed.
Right.
So looking at the very top of page 8, I'm questioning why we have that sentence about motions failing and the next one is about motions passing. It seems to me like you would only deal with motions.
And where are you looking? Where are you
looking?
Top of page 8. Page 3 of 42.
Page 3 of.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could respond, I don't know either. That was in the 97 draft.
Yeah,
so I moved that over. I don't know why the committee had that as a recommendation, so I don't have any explanation for that at this point other than that it was in there. So I was taking the 97 draft.
Thinking of things that we've dealt with that we have reconsidered. I don't recall this group ever reconsidering a motion that failed.
Well, when I read that, I assumed that that was in there because it says if less than a complete committee participated in the vote and the motion failed. So my assumption is the reason that they put that in there when I read that was that, well, if you just have barely the quorum that you need at the meeting, somebody didn't show up, that this gives you the opportunity to bring that back up again.
But normally as a chairman, you would allow a motion after time had passed, maybe new information, or the next meeting you'd allow it. Very similar motion. Well, I think we need to look at that.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I thought when I read that. I mean, otherwise, I don't think it, if I remember right from reading this, it doesn't, if you have a complete committee there, you can't take up on a motion to reconsideration a motion that failed. But the thing that makes this provision different is.
Skip again. I know the uniform rules draft. In there does say if a member who's voted on either side of a motion can move to reconsider. So I guess it's not always
prevailing side. Although these rules do make that, proposed rules.
The proposed rules.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, and it may be some of the difference between the crossover between Mason rules and Roberts rules. I would go fine with anybody on any side can make the motion to rescind or to reconsider. I mean, because you still have to have a majority vote, no matter what the case may be. So I was looking at this and I was trying to figure out what the baseline of our rules were. I think the statute set the direction of the Mason rules, but I don't know that these rules of procedure. I must confess, We have not had to have seconds to have a motion on, have we?
No.
So that means the Mason's rules have been the motivation behind the procedures here.
Yeah,
and I think that I would stay as close to them as I could.
Mr. Chair, Mason's manual is on page 4, and if you just turn the page in your handout. Section 34, Representative Coghill, on the lower left. The left page.
Oh.
Turn the page. On the bottom.
Thank you.
It doesn't say Mason's manual, but it is. That's what was taken out of Mason's.
Probably the only difference between a regularly scheduled legislative body and this is the timing, and that is you only have so many meetings in a year, so the timing of reconsideration, the 30-day timing is probably the reason that was put in there.
Mr. Chair, would Representative this is Tony Malott. So Representative Guerra made the motion for reconsideration or asked for a reconsideration, but according to this, this is only a prevailing member, and he was a substitute, isn't that correct?
He was, but when they say, I think what that means, when the prevailing member, it means a member who voted on the side that passed, which he was.
Which he was.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, well, any other thoughts with respect to?
Mr. Chairman, a question. Is this something that you wanted to vote on today?
Well, I guess we were hoping to. I was a little surprised at how complicated it actually is, and so I thought, well, maybe that's not something that's going to happen right now because of the. There's a lot of stuff in here. I mean, I would say it's one thing to consider the reconsideration by the committee that's in Mason's, which is two paragraphs, as opposed to what we have before us, which, you know, the issues that we've just talking about on the motion failing and the other side is true, and so. You know, I'm certainly willing to move forward with the consensus of the committee if people feel like they're comfortable with what's here, or if they would rather have it flushed out a little bit more, then we can table it and do that. So,
Mr. Chair, and Senator Cockfield pointed out that, you know, because there's no second required, that we are following Mason's rules, and I think the reason why we should probably stick to that is because we do have legislators that are on the committee along with both on the Senate and House side. So I think we should probably, rather than mix it in with Roberts and Mason's, we should probably stick to one, being Mason's, and then the uniform rules as well.
Yeah, and I think that this is, to some extent, trying to do it. I don't know if you had a chance to look at the, maybe you don't have the pack there, but the Mason's is, and actually in when a determination was made in the previous case, that's what I referred to and relied upon was Mason's, which is just a short two-paragraph reconsideration.
Mr. Chairman, do we dare call, ask Mr. Wayne to help us navigate through that?
I don't know if he's – Dan, have you had a chance to even sort of look at this thing?
I didn't grant
Mr. Chairman, I suggest we reconsider doing it today.
Reconsider the reconsideration.
I'd urge simplicity, or we're going to have law school in Fairbanks just to turn out attorneys so we can understand what we're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I do agree that this is not simple. At any rate, it sounds like the consensus would be to table the matter, and we'll try to. Is that? Am I reading everybody correctly here? Any opposition to that?
Unless, Mr. Chairman. No, I will not do that because that means that's a volunteer suggestion.
Yeah.
No. And Mr. Chair, they'll give a chance for the House to get their committee members in.
Yeah,
in
right.
Line.
Which they're going to have to live with it too.
Yes.
Yeah, I think all the rest of them are quite a bit easier than this one. Page 15, which is item 8B, which is committee material, correspondence, and minutes. And so Joyce will make an explanation with respect to the request for the modification procedures here.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the reason I'm bringing this before you today is because I've talked with the chair, and we have had some requests from individuals wanting to know why our minutes are not online. We don't put the minutes online because they're not online until after they're approved by the committee, and sometimes we don't meet for 6 months. And so it really doesn't give the public what I like to call the right to know what happened at the committee meeting. So I am suggesting, if you want to turn to page 16, page 16 on the bottom, I'm suggesting that for our publication of our minutes, that we do publish our draft minutes, which we have never done before, because our sort of our policy has been not to, because they're draft minutes, but actually publish the draft minutes with the word draft superimposed on all pages, because you can do that now and put that on there, make it a PDF so that, you know, they can't be changed, and just put them out there. And then once that would only be after they have been sent to you as committee members, asking you for any input or changes, you know, to what's on there, and then make those changes if there are any after Linda and I have drafted them, and then put them out there for the public, because, like I said, I've had a couple inquiries within the last 6 months. And then the approved minutes then, of course, would be the official record, and I'd put a little notice saying that and then just put them out there. So look at this one, a lot simpler than the last one. But the reason it's being suggested is because of requests for minutes. And if you ask my opinion, I don't think there's anything wrong with putting the draft minutes out there as long as they're draft. Stay draft on them.
Any additional discussion? I would entertain a motion to approve the amendment to the procedure.
Yes, so moved.
Any additional discussion?
Can we just ask your question? How often do you find, Joyce, that the draft minutes are in fact amended? I've not seen that happen very often around here.
Senator Stevens, very very few times. It might have been a typo,
yeah,
or you know, maybe missing a word or something. But other than that, I don't recall very often at all.
I think it was a good idea.
Any other comments? I can assume that the amendment is approved without objection. Seeing none, so done. The next item is informal advice disclaimer, and this is the next item in your packet. Relates to Section 9 of the procedures, and once again, Joyce will give an explanation for the reason for the request.
Mr. Chair and committee members, basically we have a disclaimer, or at least I have a disclaimer that I put at the end of the informal advice that I give. In our rules of procedure, I'm suggesting that we had actually mentioned a wrong statute, as you can see in one, and so I'm putting that up at the top and referencing a different one so that they correspond with the code. But I've also would like to add to the end of the disclaimer that pursuant to 2460-165, the committee may not bring a complaint against a person based upon information voluntarily given to the committee by the person in connection with a good faith request for advice under the 2460-158, and may not use that information against the person in a proceeding under 2460-170. That's almost the exact language out of the statute. But I think that's also important for someone who is receiving advice to know that particular information, other than the fact that, you know, that it's not binding on the committee.
Any comments or questions of Joyce with respect to what's your practice right now? Do you tell people that?
I have been telling people that, and I've actually put that on some of the advice that I give out after this. After it became more of an issue, I think, in one particular example where the person wanted to know that, and I hadn't. I always put at the end of the advice, you know, that if any of the facts are not correct, please let me know, that it's informal, it's not binding on the committee, you're welcome to request an advisory opinion and so forth. And I guess I feel that this should probably be on here as well, because that gives them some protection from when they seek advice. And since the other part was in the statute, I'm recommending that we put that in there, because that would be the whole thing that I would put at the end of the advice.
Any additional?
Yeah, I'm not sure, Gary Turner, I'm not sure if I really have a problem with this or not, but if somebody comes forth and requests your advice and or says, I did this, and tell me about it, did I mess up, does that mean that we cannot file a complaint as a committee against him?
If somebody's just telling me they did something, I would say no, because I'm not giving them advice. They're telling me what they did. But if I'm if someone is calling me and asking for advice and I'm giving out that advice and then it comes to the committee, which has happened maybe two or three times since I've been here, where it would come to the committee and the committee would say, I'm not sure I agree with that, and then I go back to that individual and say, you know, here's the advice that I gave you, but the committee feels this way, well, then they're actually protected from the advice that I gave them the first time because they followed it. But now you're saying, no, it should be changed. That's the way I'm reading it. And in a good faith request is really the committee's determination whether it's a good faith request. The way I would look at it, because as I say during training classes, if someone only gives me part of the parameters of their question, the advice I'm giving them is not answering their question because they're not telling me all of the components that go with it. So to me, that wouldn't be a good faith request because they're withholding or they didn't share that information with me. But if you want to look up the statute, it is in statute. It's 2460-165.
Mr. Chair, another question. So by the person in connection with a good faith is really the ethics administrator.
Determining a good faith request, you mean?
Yeah, the statement given to the committee by the person in connection. By the person is you. You are that person?
No, I think that's the person,
asking
for the advice.
Okay, I'm not.
Given to the committee by the person.
Given to Joyce.
Right. When it says given to the committee, that's the way the statute reads.
Yeah.
But it's given to me to give to you as as a report.
I had a question. Is the second sentence of 165, why is it not included? Are they told that there can still be a complaint brought against them and we are not limited? It seems to me that should be told to them.
And just for those of you not looking at the statute, the second section says, this section does not preclude the committee from acting on a complaint concerning the subject of a person's request for advice if the complaint is brought by another.
That needs to be there.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's kind of what you were.
Yeah, that's where I was going.
Yeah.
Okay.
Any other comments or questions?
Just in the, Mr. Chairman, this Senator Coghill, just in the ethics training, I think one of the things that is pushback on this, and I know this is the legislator having to deal with it, but they're asking for advice, and they know that advice may or may not be binding, and so they may go ahead and do something based on advice and then come back and get in trouble with the ethics committee as a whole. And but in my view, that's a decision that this committee was set up to do in that statute. So all the more reason for the administrator and the committee to be well connected. But it is true. Many of them feel that they can give advice on one thing and then finally end up in trouble by taking that advice and finding out later on the committee saw it differently.
It almost sounds like if a person comes in and asks for the advice and you give them the advice and then they don't follow it, it almost sounds like we're still limited because they gave us the information, or we could be. I mean, somewhere they say we're not limited, you know, we can't do it if they follow our advice. It doesn't say if we follow it.
Well, I read this to mean more if they're coming in and giving you some facts of things that have already occurred as opposed to future action.
I think it's more of a
I mean, I would not think that I would not read this to say if somebody comes in and says, can I campaign on the state dollar, and you say okay, and then they, or you say no, and then they go ahead and do it.
I think we have people that are assuming that they can be protected by coming in and asking for advice.
Yeah.
For something they plan to do.
Well, I don't read this as being the one saying that. Having anything to do with the advice that you give, these are the facts that you give to the.
Right.
These are the facts that you give to the committee. In other words, you come in and say, "I want to fly to Barrow for state business. I'm going to campaign. Can I do that?" And then the committee says, "No."
And then
the advice you get
then
is.
Then, if they do it anyway, can you not use those facts that they gave to you? Because
no, I think you could because those haven't occurred. Those are not things that they've done.
I guess, yeah.
Okay. That's the way I read it. I perceive this to be is if somebody comes to you and says, here are the things that have happened to me so far.
Okay, yeah.
What should I do?
I guess the second sentence does cover that in a sense. Or if the complaint arises out of conduct taking place after the advice is requested and does not, it still doesn't say that they haven't followed it. Interesting. That's a statutory problem.
Maybe, Chair, maybe some language that says and acted on that advice. I don't have a document in front of me, but it was a suggestion.
That's in the statute.
Yeah, we're stuck with the language in the statute.
Right.
I mean, I guess really the question before us right now with respect to the procedures is whether or not to include the language that's out of the statute. Plus a little bit of additional language that we just talked about.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I'm in agreement to add the language. At the very least, I'll make them dig into the statute a little bit more deeply if they want to. You know.
Okay, I'd entertain a motion to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the motion is that we would add the language in 2460-165.
The entire
provision. Any additional discussion? Any opposition to a unanimous vote? Seeing none, so done. The next is item 8D. Which is with Section 13 on potential complaints and heads up policy.
Yeah. Okay.
I think this agenda's off a little bit. Let me look at my.
I think I missed that one.
It is on
the agenda, not on this one.
Yeah, no, it's on the earlier agenda. So it's actually Section 9, informal advice. I'm sorry, the document I'm looking at left.
What page?
21.
Yeah, page 21. It's Section 9 of. Section 9 of the procedures, which is informal advice, seeking informal advice for somebody else. And Joyce, if you want to explain what brought this up.
Well, sometimes I receive calls from individuals who want to ask about someone else's actions. And it's really not the responsibility of the Ethics Committee to respond to someone else about someone else's actions. You know, if you want to call about something you want to do, I don't think, and I think I've talked to Connor about this in the past, that, you know, I shouldn't, the committee shouldn't say that, you know, if someone calls and says, well, I think, I want to know if someone engaged in a proper action, and can you tell me that? And I've had some requests regarding that, and I always say it's not the practice of the committee to provide information regarding the actions of someone other than the person who's actually calling, you know. So I've sort of come up with a statement that I tell people that we don't do that, that the purpose of the committee is really to provide advice, to provide a method by which persons covered by the code may determine if the activities they have engaged in or are contemplating engaging in are appropriate. So I can't answer for the committee if someone is doing something wrong. That's the committee's decision through the complaint process. You know, so when someone calls and asks me that, I'm going to say, no, I don't respond to that. You know, that's not my role. So I've been doing this for quite a few years, and I guess I felt that it might be important to put something in the rules of procedure saying that we don't do that. And that, and then I added the purpose of providing advice is also to provide a method by which persons not covered by the Act may determine if their contemplated interaction with a person covered by the Act will place that person in violation. So an example would be sometimes I have a lobbyist calling and ask me what they can do. You know, they're coming to visit you, Senator Coghill. Am I allowed to bring a gift? You know, and I'll say no. So actually asking about something they're going to interact with you, but what they want to do. Or I might have a corporation call me and say, you know, we're going to the legislature and we're going to have this huge campaign. Can I provide every legislator with, you know, candy or, you know, whatever? So those are the type of calls I ask or answer as well. And so I think that the role is to provide advice in that manner, but not to answer somebody's question who wants to know if Representative so-and-so did this, is that in violation or not? Because, like I said, that's not my role. That's the committee's role.
Yeah, I agree with this, but I'd like to make one suggestion. After the colon, it is not the practice of the ethics administrator to provide written.
Okay.
Because we, the committee, are not providing the informal advice. It's the ethics administrator that is.
I was wondering about some of the additional language in there, too. I mean, do you think it's really necessary to have the purpose part in there? I was thinking that maybe if we just say the practice of the committee or the ethics administrator is not, or the committee does not, or the ethics administrator does not provide informal advice to someone requesting advice for another, period.
Okay.
Something like that. Assuming that's what people want to do.
Good point.
So, Mr. Chair, you're suggesting then to say it is not the practice of the ethics administrator.
I was just going to take that part. The ethics administrator does not provide informal advice to someone requesting advice for another.
Right.
Period.
Yeah.
Leave out the.
Okay.
I feel like I'm on the committee now.
You hear me?
Okay, let me repeat that, Mr. Chair. The ethics administrator does not provide informal advice when someone is requesting advice for another. Is that what you said?
Regarding the actions of another, isn't it?
Regarding, okay.
Is that what it is? We don't want people coming in and saying, can someone else do this?
So, Mr. Chairman, could we have that read back to us again?
I'm working on it.
Both ways. I mean, you don't want somebody coming in saying, I want to ask on behalf of so-and-so, can he do this?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
that would be
quite often often I might ask my staff, you know, would you check on something? Is that inappropriate?
Well, I would say that's coming from you. It would be my.
Okay.
Most often when staff calls, they'll say, you know, I work for Representative Coghill and he wants to know.
Right.
And to me, that's you're asking.
Want is people to get politicized to where people are coming in asking if somebody else, you know, a political opponent come in asking if somebody else can do something.
That's kind of how it's come up, actually. So where it's pretty obvious that this is not really trying to get an answer to a question.
I never thought about you put it that way.
You'd be surprised some of the calls that come in.
That's exactly what's wrong.
Mr. Chair, let me try reading this back. The ethics administrator does not provide advice when someone is requesting advice regarding the actions of another. Is that what we're saying? Am I getting that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's
okay.
I mean,
And then we will delete the rest of the language. Okay.
Any other thoughts or suggestions? Can I hear a, I'll take a motion with respect to the modification to the.
Yeah, I'd like to make a motion to make the changes as just spoken by the ethics administrator.
Any additional discussion? Any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, I'll assume unanimous consent. The procedures are thereby modified accordingly. The next item. Sure. It's been about 2 hours. Should we take a – okay, why don't we take a – what do you call them? At ease?
Brief at ease. Brief.
minutes to 3 o'clock on the 19th. Senator Stevens indicated that he's got to leave at about 3 o'clock. And so with that in mind, one item that we do really need to get taken up today, and we're going to jump up on the agenda, concerns the legal contract, which is item 9 there. And if we could take that up, and then we'll go back to the procedures and get done what we can, because we'll lose the quorum when he has to leave. So. And that is the yellow.
There she is.
Okay.
Yes. No, we need three.
Yeah, we are.
I'm sorry, we need three.
At any rate, the this is the proposal. Joyce, or maybe you want to take a minute, just explain what we've got going with Brent.
Well, we do have the legal counsel contract, which expired on June 30th, and everyone was notified by email. Everybody responded by email or phone that they were okay with the contract, which is in our rules of procedure, but our rules of procedure also require that there be a public vote. So that's why it's on the agenda today. So it's just more of a formality than anything else.
So I would entertain a motion to approve the contract as outlined in your packet.
So moved.
Any discussion? And do we need a roll call since it's financial?
I take a roll call. Skip Cook.
Yes.
Senator Coghill.
Yes.
Tony Mellott.
Yes.
Senator Stevens.
Yes.
Gary Turner.
Yes.
Chair Thomas.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank
unanimous.
You. Yeah, and thank you for going out of order. Back to the procedures. The next item is on page 23 of 42, item 8. It's item 9E, actually. It's titled Potential Complaints, Informing the Subject of Information Regarding a Complaint. We've informally titled this the Heads Up Policy. Joyce was interested in sort of enshrining this in our procedures. And let me just explain to you how this came up. We had a legislator actually call raise some concerns about. Go ahead. Concerns about some activities that they were concerned about, and our policy has been this is something that had not actually occurred, and our policy has always been to notify the person, and that happened in this case. And then there was a question raised later about whether or not there was some sort of a breach of confidentiality. Of course, the caller was not identified, but at any rate, that's what's prompted this issue. I don't know if you want to say more, Joyce.
Well, I think our heads-up policy, Mr. Chair and committee members, is to help to prevent events that may have happened that are in violation, and that's what this particular call was. This individual was concerned about something that was to occur I consulted with the chair with, and that we both felt maybe we should give that individual a heads-up call, letting them know that there was some concern. And then, like the chair said, the person who called was thought that confidentiality had been breached, and of course, this individual who called, no name was ever given or anything. So the chair, if you want to go, ask for a legal opinion. So we have a legal opinion here from Brent Cole about the issue, and he did say that there was no confidentiality breached, and suggested that the heads-up policy that we have be added to our rules of procedure, and that's why it's in this. That's why it's being suggested to be added.
This is Skip again. It does not say, you have not said in here anywhere, I don't think, unless I missed it, that you won't disclose the identity of the person who...
It is. It's in from the. It's on page 24,
okay.
And it says the name of the person making the inquiry, if known, will be kept confidential.
Okay, I'm sorry. I missed it.
Gary?
Yeah, I agree with this becoming part of the rules of procedure, but I'd like to make...
Page 24, third paragraph, fourth line, where it says, however, corrective action. I'd like to insert, however, corrective action will be strongly recommended, and then insert
if there may be validity to the complaint.
The allegation, should we say, instead of complaint?
If there's validity to the allegation.
There may be. Let me read that over for the committee. The contact does not obligate the subject to take any action, remedial or otherwise. However, corrective action will be strongly recommended if there may be validity to the allegation.
Any additional comments? I'll entertain a motion to amend the
additional comment.
I'm sorry.
Sure. Dan Wayne, approaching the table here just for a second. This is a little bit nitpicky, but on page 24, where it says the name of the person making the inquiry will be kept confidential, I suggest considering maybe the identity rather than the name. And that would be consistent with how we follow the statutes a little bit, and use that term. That's all.
Is it an inquiry or is it an allegation?
Well, they're not always allegations.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of times people are calling and they say, I'm thinking about, and the policy has been to call and say, hey, so-and-so is, not so-and-so, but it's been, an issue has been raised with respect to this. So sometimes people want to know if they're violations.
What's above it said, if the person we just call it the verbal information. Yeah, I guess it's more a person bringing facts or alleging facts to the administrator. As far, are they necessarily making an inquiry, or are they just, I don't know, it may be nitpicking, but I'm just not sure inquiry is the best word there. Providing the information might be more. We're acting on the information that they've given us, right?
However, Mr. Chair, if I could comment, basically, most often, and maybe inquiry isn't the correct word, but most often people are making an inquiry, not necessarily providing us. Well, they are providing the information, but to me, if they just provide the information, then they're actually calling with an inquiry to find out whether they feel,
whether they have a basis for a complaint. Yeah.
They may have a basis for a complaint.
Are they at their inquiry as to whether they do, or is that kind of what they're doing, or are they?
In some ways, but basically the heads-up policy is more for someone calling, for both, but most often calling in the situation that the chair was referring to, that someone is contemplating this action that they're aware of. So, you know, they're making an inquiry to see whether that person, you know, if they complete that action, is it a violation in some ways? You see what I mean? And so when I checked with the chair, we felt that we needed to contact that individual and let them know, because there was an appearance, and it's hard to get into. It's really difficult for me to talk about it without sort of bringing the whole situation into light, which then would sort of let you know who the parties are, and I'm trying to prevent from doing that, so I apologize if I'm not coming through very well. But it was definitely an inquiry. But it's the committee's decision to decide if that's the word, but I guess I just want to make that clear.
Contact above another possibility to say making a contact.
Gary.
Going back to what you had said earlier, Skip, I agree the person or the identity of the person providing the information, it's a lot more general.
Well, we used the word contact. Well, that would contact work? The person making the contact? Because we've used contact in paragraph one, and we used contact at the first sentence, paragraph two. The purpose of the contact is limited to alerting, so it's maybe contact is a better.
It's consistent, yeah.
That's fine.
happens, Senator Stevens. So someone calls with the potential issue, and you, Joyce, let the individual who's involved in this know that it's a possibility that they will be in violation, and they go ahead and do that, sort of whatever it is. If the person who originally called chooses not to make a complaint, then what happens? I guess my question is, then do you then charge someone with a violation?
Senator Stevens, I guess what I would do at that point is contact the chair of the Ethics Committee and or whatever chair of the House or the Senate subcommittee and provide that information to them, and then the chair needs to make the decision whether it needs to come before the full committee.
But so it doesn't have to be handled with by a complaint by the person who initiated. They can bow out then and say, I've done my part.
You know, and actually sometimes people have called and said, I don't want to file a complaint, but so-and-so is doing.
Okay,
or so-and-so is planning on doing something, and then we've always felt like it's part of our role to, especially if something's not happened, and even if we're not sure that it's going to be a violation, if you just put somebody on notice that somebody thinks that it might be, then they can make their own
right
decision.
And I think inquiry does work because, for example, with as many volunteers as I've had work with me, they don't know all what is going to be ethical and unethical. And they may go headlong into something, and then finally somebody might call me, like Joyce might call me and say, you know, somebody asked about this, and then I'll go, oh, no, really? You know, I mean, that has happened to me before. I've had things progress way down the road before I caught it. So it does happen. And usually it's somebody who's volunteered, all good intentions, just they don't know the rules.
Dan?
I this might add something to the discussion. I thought Senator Stevens raised this point. At some point, you know, when the person received the heads-up call, well, thank you very much for the heads-up. So, Joyce, what's your opinion? If I do this, will I? What do you think about it? You told me that someone else is thinking that this thing I'm doing might be a violation, but you haven't said what you think. And does that become an informal request for an informal opinion at that point? Does it change from just being a heads-up call to a request for an informal opinion by the person you called? And I can see where that issue might come up. If some action was taken later by the committee, the person could say, well, could have just said thanks for the heads up, but instead I asked for advice, and so now you think that she should, or the committee shouldn't use the things that I told Joyce. I don't know how that fit in with your policy. But
if I could just make a comment, Mr. Chair, if I could, and an example came to mind when you said that is, and one I usually mention at training is that, you know, like sometimes a member of the public will call and say they saw a particular they saw this legislative staffer at 2 o'clock in the afternoon campaigning, and they're pretty sure they were on state time. You know, I mean, that's their perception because that's their hours people work. And I may call that staffer and you know, sort of give them a heads up. And did you adjust your hours? Did you file a leave slip? They don't have to answer that, of course, but they do. And in one particular instance, the individual said, uh-oh, I forgot to file a leave slip, and this was like 3 weeks previous. So they did ask me, what would you do? And I said, well, I'd file a leave slip today, you know what I mean, to get that in. So I don't know if that's what you're referring to, but I would definitely say that if they asked me, you know, what would you recommend, I would say, well, file that leave slip. And that's an example that comes to mind.
Okay. Yeah, in response to Dan, I think that heads-up call then becomes a request for informal advice. If they make that request, if they come back and say, okay, Joyce, what do you think? What should I do? Then the tone and the purpose of the call changes.
Well, this does say, however, corrective action will be strongly recommended, and then it does go a short step.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer simply a heads up.
Any additional comments? then did you any comfort level on the word of either inquiry or contact?
The one she just described is more of a report than an inquiry. I mean, you know, I saw this guy out there, you know, campaigning. That's a report.
That's why I like to provide the information.
So the name of the person providing the information?
The identity of the person.
Or the identity, yeah, of the person providing the information. Any objection to that? So, okay, well, I'd entertain a motion then to modify the rules of procedure as outlined here as modified on two different occasions. Any additional discussion? Any opposition to modification? Seeing none, the rules of procedure are modified unanimously as outlined. The next item is section 16, decisions, dismissals not made public, and Joyce once again can explain what she...
Section 17. Okay.
17.
And Linda, if you could hand out the other item. Basically, the recommendation for this item is that the Ethics Office received a subpoena for copies of a complaint that was dismissed. And when a complaint is dismissed for one of several reasons, they're not public documents according to statute. The rules of procedure on the bottom of page 35 really only said dismissal for lack of jurisdiction. But however, the statute reads not just lack of jurisdiction, but also due to insufficient credible information that could be uncovered to warrant further investigation, as frivolous on its face, or if the allegation, even if true, would not constitute a violation of the act. And so I felt, based on the subpoena that we received and that our rules of procedure were incomplete, that we needed to add those other items in there that are taken from the statute. And then in reviewing the materials last night, I would make the recommendation on page 36 that we take out on the second line when a complaint is dismissed under section 14A. For some reason, that doesn't make sense, and I got a feeling it was in there previously, and I never caught that. So I would recommend we take that out when a complaint is dismissed under section 14A, because Linda just handed out another sheet. I don't think I received one. Did we have another one? Section 14A or 14 also talks about complaints dismissed for lack of jurisdiction, and I think we should add the information into that section as well as this section to make them consistent as to that's why those are particular type of complaints. Because referencing that particular section, there's a whole bunch of issues there, like six of them, and they don't all apply to this. So I think that reference on page 36 should be removed.
So the suggestion is to modify the procedures, section 17 and then section 14?
Yes, okay. Section 17 and 14 to coincide with each other. And what it is it's just changing, like I said, where it says on the bottom of page 35 where it says dismissal for lack of jurisdiction, it's just saying dismissal prior to investigation, adding the other rules, adding the other ones that were listed in statute. And it only became apparent because of the subpoena we received and when I went to check our rules of procedure. It wasn't covered, but yet it's covered in the statute, so I feel it should be consistent. And plus the one that was just handed out.
I'd like to make a motion to add this to the rules of procedures as proposed.
Okay, both sections, section 17 and section 14. Any additional discussion? Any opposition? I'll assume that that there's unanimous consent to modify both Section 17 and Section 14 as outlined. Next item is the budget update.
Mr. Chair, did you want me to go over the budget? Sorry.
Okay. We should note that Representative Gardner is now sitting in for the alternate Representative Tuck.
Okay, the budget, on the first white page, after the contract is the budget update for fiscal year 11, which is the year that we're in right now, started on July 1st and runs through June 30th. These are the totals for the expenditures that we have, and what our balance is. And we will definitely have funds to cover any expenses through the end of the year, unless for some reason we have a public hearing or something. So those are that's fiscal year 11 budget update. I don't know if there's any questions regarding that. I did provide earlier what we had spent on office and so forth, and some of that was in a couple years, over a two-year period. The fiscal 12 budget, I know I received a memo from Pam Barney on November 30th saying that there were no changes to any of the other budgets and that there was an adjustment of health insurance increase and COLA increase. And the changes were reflected in the governor's figures, and then that there were no changes there. So basically, the budget that was sent out is with those updated totals, but the same budget from the previous year. Same number of positions and everything.
Yeah, for the third year in a row, I'd like us to pursue step increase for the administrator. So perhaps the new chair could discuss with finance co-chairs, as we did last year, to determine their acceptance to move forward for a step increase. Yeah, I'd like to make a motion that the Chair Walker and the administrator, and I'd volunteer to also assist with this, to provide the ethics administrator a step increase as has been requested the last 2 years.
I think he means you.
Oh, sorry. Chair Cook. I always feel better saying if he's not here.
Any discussion with respect to the motion, which is to pursue a step increase for Joyce? Joyce, you want to call a roll? We should probably vote on it.
Senator Coghill?
Yes.
Tony Mallott?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Gary Turner?
Yes.
Skip Cook?
Yes.
Chair Thomas? Unanimous vote, Mr. Chair. Representative Gardner is not a member of the vote. Right?
Yeah, you're right.
I was going to motion that or whisper that to you, but
you can mail your vote in Friday.
Technically, we can do that. That's a good idea. We'll just in the future help you.
That's right. All of Joyce had a question in terms of what your thoughts are on how it is that the committee should proceed with respect to the step increase.
I think we should annotate the budget as we did last year and then schedule meetings with the co-chairs and perhaps ask for assistance from the Senate President on that side of the House.
I think, you know, I think Joyce is just not comfortable dealing with the issue herself.
Then I'd suggest that Chair Cook and I could work on that, perhaps with guidance. Mm-hmm.
Okay. The next item is the you have budget request down here. I'm not really asking for anything.
No, that's what we're dealing with right now.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was the budget update. Okay, the budget.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Yes.
So, the next item is the use of state resources in campaigning. This is really an informational item. There's been, as you can see in the packet, Joyce has sort of outlined the number of times we've discussed this. It's the green one. Although the my understanding is that the legislature is willing to take this up this year. And either decide to leave things the way they are or to make whatever modifications that they feel is appropriate with respect to this issue. I know we had a brief conversation today with Senator Coghill. Maybe you have some comments with respect to this issue.
Sure. I don't know that the legislature is going to be totally in agreement with this. This will be an ongoing discussion. But I have heard some general consensus that this is something we should deal with. So I've talked with the leadership on the House and the Senate to find out how this might move forward. I'm willing to do it on the Senate side as long as there's some at least understanding that it will get out into a public hearing. I haven't gotten that totally yet, but I'm willing to do it, but I have found out that the rules chairman on the House side is willing to put in a rules committee bill, and I think that gives it a little more horsepower. So my commitment is to help him with the language sets, and I appreciate the committee has put together a pretty good resource base of prior discussions. And so thanks to Joyce, I think we can find a language set within there, knowing what the debate has been, and really trying to find out what is ethical and what isn't ethical with the big geographical area that we have to serve on how do you divide that up. So my expectation is it will be a full-blown discussion this year. It did not make it very far last year. So there was one lightning rod issue that was in there, and that was the meal issue that became very contentious and I think probably put the brakes on the bill finally at the end of the day. So it's my intention not to bring that into that discussion, leave that for another day, and just talk about some of the issues. And there are some good issues in here on dealing with resources that I think need to be brought up, and that's the mailing list issue. And there's probably about four house cleaning items in here, but the real issue is dealing with these resource questions that in campaign times. So I think that's a big issue. The amendments that I was trying to put in the statute on definitions are very, very problematic. So my guess is those won't get very far. And so I will probably work on them privately, trying to figure out what is a good way to look at those things. And trying to find out what those who attend COGL, for example, have had to deal with in some of those issues on constituent services. So it's still an unanswered question in my mind. But I was going to go ahead and submit it, but I wanted to go around and find out who was doing what in the building, and it looks like there's a lot of interest in the issue. So even the co-chair of finance, both of them were willing to entertain it. So I have a feeling that it's as long as we can find a good language set that really passes what I would consider a good ethical test. That's what we have to. We know it's unethical for somebody to use state money to go campaigning with. But we also know that there are some places in Alaska where you have to travel that may take days. And the more centralized area of Alaska, the South Central, has an advantage in that regard. And it's just so how to divide that fairness and still stay on an ethical ground, either based on action or intent, depending on how the language sets come up. I'm willing to work on it, and I think the legislature has an open. I think listening to the discussion I had during the mandatory training, it sounded like there was some interest in this. So I'm willing to work on it again. I wasn't willing to work on it if it was just going to be a bill that gets written up and then left. So it looks like there's enough interest to move it forward.
And the issue of standardizing reporting periods that we've talked about as well.
I have a feeling we'll address that.
Yeah, I was sort of that item I felt like should have its own little area on the agenda in terms of the travel. The next really is a sort of a legislation update, and I was going to let you speak to your issue, your concern there. So if you want to.
Well, I thought it makes sense that we include all of that in this omnibus piece of legislation, you know, I guess the problem that so many people have faced in this issue is some reporting requires 60 days, others require 30 days, and so often folks are having to turn in an estimate because it takes often, and we're going to see that happen more and more. NCSL and CSG, the national organizations, are helping fund more legislative travel to conferences, and that's going to happen more and more, I believe. And you put you in a bind where you can't get the information from them in 30 days of the actual before, so you have to file a temporary report and then refile it when you actually have the actual figures. It's just unnecessary time on everyone's part. It doesn't seem to add anything to knowing what legislatures are spending in travel. So it seems to me it makes sense because it's so easy. We've said before and more, but many times this is not a matter of gotcha. Okay, you missed 30 days, now we gotcha, because you thought everything else was 60 days. I think standardizing it just makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, in the packet you have it's my understanding that in large part that the legislative ethics bill that was introduced, House Bill 193, by Representative Coghill and Max Grunberg will likely be the in large part the vehicle this year. And Joyce has gone through and sort of outlined what she understands to be the committee's position with respect to the various sectional analysis in there or provisions in there. And so I guess now is really the time to have people take a look at that and see if there's any discussion they feel necessary or differences of opinion with respect to the comments that you see at the bottom that are provided by Joyce and really on behalf of the Ethics Committee. And this is this is labeled attachment number one.
So the one thing, Mr. Chairman, that I did talk about was there was a stipend section in there for public committee members here. I'm open to discussion. That does make it go through the Finance Committee, but I will probably start without it and see what the pleasure of the legislature is, because once the bill gets into some committee's hands, it is their property. You know, I may be able to manage it through the legislature, or the rules chairman may be able to manage it, but it really does become amendable. So I will probably start without that.
And I think at least the position of the Ethics Committee is that it's not taking a position really on this. The suggestion was to take it out, if anything. Any additional comment? Everybody seems to be okay with kind of the position that the committee's taken with respect to the various sections of the proposed legislation. All right. We'll assume that's the answer is yes to that. So, and as you probably all noted, looking at this, the bill is here, the sectional analysis is here, and the comments from the sponsor statement are also included in the packet. Anything else, Joyce, you want to say on with respect to the legislation?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I just wanted to point out that Attachment 3, and I think this came up at all the legislator training, of which the public members were there as well, but maybe for the record, that Attachment 3 is kind of a historical perspective of the legislative travel and campaign activity, and it actually goes back to 1993, and hopefully Senator Coghill or anyone else is going to be working on the bill would be able to look at this historical perspective and see that it has been an issue that has been discussed. And then I also included minutes from the committee meetings, somehow State Affairs, I think. I don't think it went to the Senate. I think it was all in the House. And there's minutes in here that, as you can see, there is the same discussion that occurred during the committee meetings, at the legislative committee meetings. And they also had some suggestions in there for language, so I included everything in here that's ever been suggested, like from the Ethics Committee, from the bill, and so forth. So hopefully that will be helpful. And if I didn't include the minutes in here from all of the committee meetings that we've had, but if you would like, I have them in one particular area that I could just forward them to you, Senator Coghill, because that also talks about, you know, where the committee and the discussion went with legislators and so forth. So that would be the only other component that isn't in here that might be helpful, and I could forward them to you.
Mr. Chairman, I think that would probably would be a good idea. My intention was to include this in the backup as the bill travels, probably line them up a little bit. The intention that I have is to take some of the language sets that have been proposed previously, and if I can find good enough ground to actually have a conclusive one that I would support, I would put that in there, but at least to show what the various discussions were and then index them to the history. So that particular set of minutes would be helpful, as well as the legislative history on it, because it has been discussed quite a bit, and there has to be at least a target conclusion somewhere. I'm hoping I can supply that. We'll see.
Would it be helpful if we devoted an issue of our newsletter to a capsulization of that material and indicated that the committee has been working with, it's an item that's come before our committee for years, and that we've had to deal with the language as it is.
The answer is I don't know. Generally, in a packet of information, at least from my perspective as a manager of a bill, I would make sure that people understand what the backup is. The committee providing that may very well be helpful.
It would have to be pretty.
But you almost have to, and it's really a perspective that I'm looking at, not the information, the perspective. And the perspective has to say, this is the bind you put the committee in, and this is what we've discussed. As you're considering it, here is some information that we've had to deal with. So that may very well be the perspective to look at it from. But any information at this point to show that it's been a conundrum is helpful.
It's another way to get it out in front of people. And there were some newer legislators this morning at the training who didn't seem to realize that this had been an ongoing thing, and it might be helpful for people to realize that it's not something that's new or capable of a quick fix, but it needs to be fixed.
The answer is I'm okay with that, and but I'm just one. But it looks like I'll probably be involved in it to a pretty good degree.
Well, we appreciate you taking it on. Any other legislative discussion? Seeing none, then the next item is any other business? Any before the committee? See a lot of shaking heads. The answer is no. The next item is adjournment. I would ask for a motion.
So moved.
Well, that was painless.
Thank you all for coming.
Show up 2 hours late.